the reason these disturbances, they followed you to a new home, is because it's not the house that's haunted. It's your son.
So 1,100 men went in the war. 316 men come out. The Sharks took the rest June the 29th, 1945. Anyway, we delivered the bomb.
Never, ever, ever, under any circumstances, say, I'll be right back. Because you won't be back.
You get another beer, you want one?
Yeah, sure.
I'll be right back!
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Oh, shit.
My name is Robert Hawkins. Approximately 7 hours ago, something attacked the city. You found this. If you're watching this, then you know more about it than I do.
California, stay away from me. Stay away from me. I'll come in here. John Doe has the upper hand.
And on that day, Ahab will go to his grave, but he'll rise again within the hour. He will rise and beckon that all save one shall follow.
They're all gonna laugh at you! They're all gonna laugh at you! They're all gonna laugh at you!
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire, in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how's it going, sir?
I am well.
Excellent. And a Connecticut American?
This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how's it going?
I'm doing pretty good, thank you.
All right, very good. We have a couple of people missing tonight, but we do have a special guest, so let's introduce him now. And who is that, also from the state of Michigan?
Hey, it's Dan.
Dan, how are you, sir?
I'm pretty good. I'm nervous about this, I gotta be honest. I've never done this.
Well, you haven't done Dark Discussions. This is your first time being on Dark Discussions, but people may know you from somewhere else, and what's that other podcast that you do with your buddy Eric?
Well, it's called the Ascansity Podcast, and that's where Eric tries to hold things together in an orderly fashion, and I poke holes.
That is true. That is true.
That's a fair description.
It is. It is. Yep. So it's a general interest podcast where they talk about general stuff in the news, music, arts, things of that nature. And you can find it wherever podcasts are found. We are darkdiscussions.com is the website. Email is darkdiscussions@aol.com. You can find us on Facebook under Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group. At the bottom of every page of www.darkdiscussions.com, links to all those things. Eric, also, what else do we have on that website?
Oh, there's a bunch of stuff. At the top, you can find a link to our articles page, where there are articles that have been written by myself and others. There's also an audio link that will take you to a page that has every single episode of Dark Discussions, as well as all its spinoff podcasts, available for download for free. The price is right, so go check it out. There's bound to be something there you're interested in. And then on the very front page, front and center, is a link to our Patreon account. Patreon is a service that lets you support your online artists financially. Producing this podcast is not free. Sometimes horrible things happen, and we have to do things like buy new computers. Right, Phil?
Yeah, we had a massive crash right before we recorded, what's the name of that episode? Midsummer.
Yes. So, it's not free for us to do this. It actually costs us money. So if you'd like to help offset the cost of producing this podcast, you can follow the link on the front page of darkdiscussions.com or go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions. And for every $5 a month that you care to donate, you'll have the opportunity to submit a topic for us to possibly cover on the podcast. We take all the submissions from our donors and draw them on a quarterly basis randomly to have a topic from one of our listeners be an episode. So if you want to do that, you can follow the link on the front page at darkdiscussions.com or go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions.
Yep, very good, very good. And when I say a crash, I mean a complete system failure and a mechanical failure. The hard drive is Yeah, yeah. So the computer is now in the closet collecting
dust.
It's
a doorstop.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, fortunately, it was being used as the recording podcast, and after recording, I always move it to the cloud, so we didn't lose anything of note, and I didn't keep anything on there that hadn't been backed up on other places, thank God. All right, so we do have some house cleaning things besides that that we will discuss after near the end of the episode. One last thing I wanted to say before we begin, for new listeners, who we are and what we do. We basically discuss and dissect each week a different film, generally a genre film, so horror, sci-fi, fantasy, thriller, techno-thriller, mystery, grindhouse, cult, art house, foreign, and midnight movie, and things of that nature, basically trying to talk intelligently about a genre that deserves intelligence. Now,
we'll get there someday.
Someday, yes. Well, maybe today.
No.
Well, we'll find out. All right, so Eric, what is this episode that we're going to do tonight that I think Dustin Watson of Horror, no, it's not Horror Card anymore, it's Watsy Podcast, he kind of predicted something about this.
Did he?
Yeah, he goes, when I wrote, I said I was watching this film last night, or two nights ago, whenever it was, and he posted under it, he goes, oh, is Dan Hunter joining you? Is this going to be an episode?
So oh, wow. I missed that. Good for him. Good call, Watson.
Yeah. So what is this?
Although, to be fair, I think we may have mentioned it on his Scansity, so he may have been tipped off by us.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and I think we mentioned we were going to do Melancholia after we did Jack, but I don't think we mentioned Dan. But
we have to sneak these in when Mike isn't around, because Mike refuses to watch Lars von Trier.
That's really? Right.
Yeah.
Why?
Because he doesn't like him.
Oh.
Yeah. Something, but he's not really into certain types of art house, and I guess the Von Trier type of art house doesn't work for him, or something. That's all I can guess. I don't know, but we've already kind of introduced the film. But Eric, why don't we do it the way we usually do? So, Eric, what are we going to discuss tonight?
All right, tonight we're going to discuss the 2011 film starring Kirsten Dunst, directed by Lars von Trier, Melancholia.
Won't even bother saying how late you are.
So sorry, guys.
We're only there. Mm-hmm. That was 2 hours ago.
Toast to the bride and the groom.
Ladies!
You look glowing today. Never seen you look so happy.
I'm thrilled about this wedding, and I know it's costing John a lot of money. It's not about the cost. I thought you really wanted this. But I do. What star is that? The red one.
I don't know.
What's going on, Justine?
It's a planet that has been hiding behind the sun. Now it passes by us.
I just have one thing to say. Enjoy it while it lasts. I myself hate marriages.
Can we please? Is everyone in your family star raving mad?
I smile and I smile and I smile.
You're lying to all of us.
I'm not really happy.
This could have been a lot different.
Yes, Michael, that could have been.
Just forget it. Stop dreaming, Justine.
What are we excited about?
Tomorrow night.
That's right.
I'm afraid of that stupid plan.
And it is not going to hit us.
You promise? Life is only on Earth. And not for long.
I don't think you know that at all. Sometimes I hate you so much.
Justin, I want to do this the right way.
I'm afraid that the planet will hit us anyway.
That's right, 2011 film. The film is written and directed by Lars von Trier. Originally, the film was going to be starring Penelope Cruz, but she had to drop out.
Yeah, that's weird to me. I can't even imagine that version of the movie.
Yeah, I know. It is interesting. Well, you know what? I've seen her in that Vanilla Sky.
Oh, she's a good actress. Don't get me wrong. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just different. Yeah. Yeah. You can't see this film made without the people who are in it now. But basically, the film stars Kirsten Dunst, who came in as the replacement for Penelope Cruz, and Charlotte Gainsbourg. Charlotte Gainsbourg is probably best known for working with Lars von Trier on a number of films. Plus, she is the daughter of Jane Birkin, the famous model from the 60s and 70s, and known for the invention of the Birkin bag. And
don't leave out her father.
That's what I was about to say.
Gainsbourg, probably the best French pop artist ever.
Yes, I was able to finish because Eric interrupted me. But yes, Jane Birkin and Serge Gainsbourg are her parents. And as Dan said, he's also was a famous movie director, not director, actor as well, and various other things he did. And then the film also has folks like Charlotte Rampling, another famous English actress and model from the past, John Hurt, Stellan Skarsgård, including his son Alexander Skarsgård, though they don't play father and son in the film, Udo Kier, Kiefer Sutherland, and Brady Corbett, people who probably know him from the American version of Funny Games. So it's a pretty large cast and whatnot.
So, Phil, you can't just sort of like Birkin bag out there and not explain what the fuck it is.
It's like a basket.
Yeah, it's a famous bag woman buy and whatnot. And it was a type of bag this woman had or needed or something. And some guy on an airplane decided to start creating the bag and named it after her because she was kind of using one. I mean, if you've seen the Birkin bag, just Google it. You'll know what it is. Right. See it. Yeah. It's fairly popular. Chrissy may have one. I don't know. But Chrissy, do you have a Birkin bag?
No, I do not.
Sadly. What? You don't spend $8,000 on purses?
I don't. Huh. I don't.
I do
spend like $50 or $60 though on like the good ones, like that are Disney and you know whatever. I am a bag girl.
I call that a purse.
A purse, a bag, a handbag, a pocketbook. I always called it a pocketbook.
No, I just googled it. I know what you're talking about now. I'd never heard that name before though.
Right. Well, it's a special type of one of those. If you're a woman, you would know what it is.
Well, I'm not a woman.
On the side about Serge Gainsbourg, he had a, not only was he married to Jane Birkin, he also had an affair with Brigitte Bardot.
That's correct. That is correct. Yeah. And for folks, I think we did mention that he was a Frenchman, but we may have skipped that.
Yeah.
That reminds me of a great line from, have you ever seen the movie Dirty Rotten Scoundrels?
I'm not. Yes. I know who stars in it. Was Steve Martin.
At the beginning of the movie, Steve Martin gets thrown in jail in France, and he's trying to convince the police officer to let him out. And he goes, come on, I got caught with another woman. You're French, you understand. And the police officer says, being with another woman, that is French. Getting caught, that is American.
There you go. One other thing of note that I wanted to bring up is that the film uses Wagner's prelude to Tristan and Isolde.
You opened the door, Phil. I have quite a bit to say about the music when you want me to.
Yeah, sure. We can do that at any point. Which is awesome music. It was used in Excalibur for folks who have seen that film. Plus, of course, it is famous music anyway, because if you get the greatest hits of Wagner, it's always on the disc. Also, a cinematographer is Manuel Alberto Claro, who has done pretty much all of Lars von Trier's films. And the editor this time is Molly Malene Stensgaard. I'm not sure much about her, but I would not doubt that she's Swedish because this film was filmed in Sweden.
And they're all Swedes.
There you go. And it was filmed at that famous castle in Sweden, too. I forget the name of it.
Oh, that one.
Yeah, it's pretty famous, though. Anyway, I guess we can... here it is. Tolohome Castle, it's called. Okay. Tolohome Castle in Holland, Sweden. So it's a very famous.
Now, is it Holland or is it Harland?
Holland, Halland.
So okay, just checking.
Yeah, it's neither. All right. So I guess we can discuss how we heard about this film and what we thought about it. So let's start with you, Eric.
How did I hear it? I think I was following Lars von Trier at the time this came out. I honestly don't recall if this is pre or post Antichrist. I think it's post after
this
Antichrist.
Post, yeah.
But I actually initially was introduced by Lars von Trier with the movie Dancer in the Dark, which stars Bjork. Another cheerful movie. I just was paying attention and saw it was coming out, and I was interested in watching another Lars von Trier film. So I watched it when it came out. I honestly can't remember if I had a chance to see it in the theater or not. But whatever the case may be, I now own a copy on Blu-ray. And this is a fantastic movie. Great acting, great cinematography. The story's a little weird. But it's got some stuff in it that's very, very impactful and significant to me personally, if not to anybody who watches the movie. And I like it. I think it's a great movie.
All right, very good. For me, I forget how I heard about the film. I had seen only one film prior that was directed by Lars von Trier, and that was the same film that you mentioned, Eric, Dancer in the Dark. It was the night my appendix blew up, so I'll never forget that
film.
Oh,
Jesus.
I was in a massive fever and I had to get rushed to the hospital, but not until after the movie. yes. There you go. I'm a champ. And it was the night before Easter too, as a matter of fact. But I was a fan of Kirsten Dunst, and this was right when she was just beginning to start doing art house films. And I heard it was science fiction-y, so I had good reviews, so I always had it on my list. I finally watched it about 6 years ago, 5 years ago, when I bought the DVD on a whim. And I remember liking it a lot then. And then I upgraded it to Blu-ray about a year ago when I updated like four or five of my old DVD films into that were cheaper, that are, you know, only like $8 to $10. And so I bought this one as one of them. And so I rewatched it again last night, and I forgot how awesome this film is. You can laugh at certain parts because, I mean, it is really just first world problems. It's like, you know, big effing deal. But if you just look at people as individuals and not from their, class or things or country they're from, you can see what he was trying to do here. At least I felt, even though I'm sure Dan will say, nope, Phil, you're absolutely wrong, or something else. But it was the type of film I would usually watch that has kind of a depressing tone, like Midnight Cowboy or something. It's a pretty solid film, rock solid. Again, it's an art house film, and it's not science fiction like space opera. Or even hard science fiction, like some of the films that we've done on this, like The Martian or whatnot. But it is still a solid science fiction film that technically turns into a horror as it is the end of the world in a sense. So high recommend, but for a select audience. Chrissy.
Okay, so I was very excited about this movie. I thought, honestly, that the poster art was gorgeous, and the imagery in this movie is stunning. I was very piqued. My interest was very piqued by the trailer that I watched, and so I was excited to watch it. I have never seen one of this director's movies before. So this was my first experience, I'm pretty certain, with Lars. I was a little bit disappointed in it. I don't think it was quite what I was expecting. I found it to be a little bit on the pretentious side. Like, let's have 8 minutes of ash falling and people moving fingers. And I was like, all right, do we really need all this? Like, I literally, like, fast-forwarded through that. I'm like, okay, when does the actual story start? I did like certain things. I think the acting was excellent. I mean, Kiefer Sullivan is just freaking great in anything he does. I really enjoyed him. I am really glad that Kirsten Dunst was in this because she was fantastic. I think all the acting in this was great. I do think, like I said, the story in terms of, I don't want to give away spoilers, but the story in the beginning or in the first half is a little bit subversive and you really have to pay attention to what's going on. It's not really clearly spelled out. I think it's very well done in terms of showing something as it would be in real life. But I don't know. I was kind of sitting there going, okay, I know this is supposed to be like deep or something, but it's just kind of not, there's not enough here for me to really work with in terms of analyzing the dialogue. I think it was sort of basic, but that's okay. I'm going to say that, I like movies, any kind of movie that is apocalyptic in a sense. And I will talk more about that when we get to the spoiler. But I don't know. I think this is certainly a movie that isn't going to be for everyone. I would say the second half is much stronger and much more interesting than the first half. But that's, anyway, that's what I thought. I'm not very eloquent tonight. I'm sorry. I had a really kind of emotional week and I'm just sort of out of it. But yeah. So anyway.
All right. Very good. For a couple things, Kirsten Dunst did win the Best Actress Award at Cannes for this film when it back in, I think, 2011, 2012. And rightfully so. And interesting take, Chrissy, because I think a lot of folks may actually think the first part was the better part than the second, but we'll get into that. Now it's Dan. What about yourself? How did you hear about this film, and what did you think of it?
Well, I came to Lars von Trier through Antichrist, and then there was this TV show he did in Denmark in the 90s that was weird, but I kind of liked it. So this was, for me, when it came out, it was like a must-see kind of thing. And I actually probably saw it in an actual art house. But, yeah, I would say a couple things. I'm going to lend to the pretentious side of this. I sort of view it as way less a tale of science fiction and more like an exploration of kind of like sort of 19th century German nihilism. And that comes through in a few places that I'll point out when it's time. But that's, I think it's more an exploration of that sort of philosophical movement and its underpinnings than anything else. That's it.
All right. Very good. All right. So before we discuss preliminary stuff, Eric, do we have a wiki for this?
Wiki.
All right.
Can you do that one more time, please?
Wiki.
Thank you.
Eric's done this about almost 400 times now.
That's true. All right. So the one on IMDb is very short and sweet. Two sisters find their already strained relationship challenged as a mysterious new planet threatens to collide with Earth.
All right. That sounds good.
It's true.
Yep.
Very simplified, but true.
Yep. All right. So that's good. We'll talk about more things in detail during the spoiler part. But I guess we can talk about things in general. Dan, what made you get interested in Lars von Trier and come on this podcast because, I mean, we've had a lot of topics, but, I mean, this is the one that really piqued your interest was when Eric obviously brought this up to you.
Yeah, I think, I mean, to be fair, so like my undergrad degree is in philosophy and I'm married to an artist. So a lot of the things that are important in my worldview sort of have always been representative in Lars von Trier films. And then when Eric mentioned that you guys were doing it, that sort of excited me because I really don't get to talk about this film much. Usually when I try to, it's to a group of very sweaty, tired people who look at me like I'm insane. And yeah, so this is going to be fun for me.
All right, very good. Now, Chrissy, what I'm just curious. In it, basically, let me explain. The movie's broken up in two parts, two sisters. The first half is named after with the, you know, the title
Justine.
Card, Justine, and then the second one, Eric,
Claire.
That's right, and it's kind of a different tone completely, and generally with Dunst obviously shining, especially to the point where she won Cannes Best Actress Award. A lot of folks have always talked about that first half is the most interesting, especially since it's kind of the documentary feel that it does and all that. But Chrissy, you said you felt you liked the second half a little better. Why don't you explain a little bit about that?
Well, I liked the second half better because I thought that it was much easier to follow in terms of what was actually going on. Do we have spoiler flag up yet?
Not yet.
Okay, I just want to be careful. I think that the dialogue was stronger. I think the relationship dynamic was a little bit... In the first half, we get the relationship dynamic between the sister. So we kind of understand it. So it's a good foundation in the first half. But in the second half, we actually get into... the planet is approaching and the problems with that, and Claire and her husband and what their dynamic is like. And that to me was just a little bit more interesting because it appeals more to the science fiction fan that is kind of more interested in what happens to a microcosm, right, when you know the end is coming. And yeah, that is the stuff that really floats my boat. For example, the entire movie of these final hours. Mm-hmm. The second half of the movie felt more like these final hours to me, and that was probably why I found it more interesting. The first half to me was just kind of a setup, and because I felt that the dialogue between a lot of the characters was kind of whatever, let's talk about this bowl of onion soup, I really couldn't grab anything. I was like, okay, I understand that the sister has an illness. You know, Justine has an illness. I understand that Claire is the caretaker. But the rest of it was sort of like, I'm not really sure what all these other people have to do with anything. Like, they're all talking about,
well,
you know,
I have more to say about that.
Yeah. And
but
I mean,
I'm going to wait till the spoiler.
And I am very okay with the fact that I may have missed something, that I'm sure there was a lot of deep stuff going on here, and it just wasn't interesting enough for me to really care. I was just whatever,
Chrissy,
you know.
Let me ask you this, because maybe you went in knowing that, you know, it's the end of the world type of film, so you probably weren't prepared to see the first hour being really more of a drama and about maybe how a person is in a life that she doesn't like around people who she feels are shallow or whatever. And you were probably expecting the whole film was going to be like the second half where it was prepping up for, like you said, these final hours type of film. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it would have been better if you went
in
blind, maybe.
I agree with you. I think that was why I was disappointed. I personally the idea of, okay, it's your wedding day. This is the way I would have done this if I had written it. I would have said, it's your wedding day. You know the end of the world is coming.
Well, they don't know that.
Doing it anyway. Right. And I understand that they don't know it yet. Sorry, that's my cell phone. I understand that they don't know that yet. But I would have just done it differently. And I think I was expecting it to be written differently. And so that's why I got a little thrown off. I'm not going to say the first half was boring or that I hated it. No, it's beautifully shot. There is a nice documentary feel to it. I particularly love found footage and documentaries. So anything that's shot like that really appeals to me. I thought the acting was great. I love the dynamic between Kiefer Sullivan and his wife. I mean, you know, I'm not saying it was terrible. I'm just saying I think that I couldn't grab things out of it and I was expecting something different. Or maybe for an art house film, I wanted it to be a little bit less pretentious and a little bit more, I don't know, intense. I mean, my God, that wedding band was lame. Like, I was like, Jesus, they spent all this money on this wedding? What the fuck with this band? It sounds like they're on a Casio. Like, all right, whatever. I used to play in a wedding band. So, but yeah, so anyway, did I answer your question, Phil? Did that make any sense?
No, that's fair. I was just curious. Again, though, yeah, I mean, the first half isn't really a genre film at all. It's really more of a kind of a art house drama film. I mean, let me rephrase that. It's not like a genre film at all. It's more like a art house drama film. So
yeah, I would agree.
And I don't think anybody can argue with Christy when she says it's pretentious, because that's part of what Von Trier does. That's his thing. So yeah, it's pretentious. I don't
mind art, and I love the imagery, I love the art, I love symbols, I love, you know, like they've got that painting in the beginning, the hunters in the snow, which obviously symbolizes that the sister and she are alone in the world together dealing with her illness. You know, they are wanderers in the snow, you know, in this barren kind of cold, freezing landscape. They're the only warm people that understand what's going on. And I get that. And I get that was in contrast to the actual wedding going on. But it just, I don't know. When I say pretentious, I mean, at MFA programs, I've talked about this before, it's like navel gazing. It's like, oh, let's have a lot of pretty shit. And it really doesn't have to mean anything. It's just so pretty. Like, and it doesn't move the story forward. You can still be really intense and beautiful with your imagery and artsy and out there, but have it have a reason and not just show me a bunch of stuff where I'm like, all right, that none of this looks like it's related. We're just showing it to be beautiful for beauty's sake. And that's fine. It's just that is not my kind of film. And that's what I mean when I say pretentious.
That's cool.
It's like, it's, you know, but I'm not going to say the film was bad. I just liked the second half better.
I wasn't criticizing your take. I was agreeing with it. Yes, Lars von Trier is pretentious. I just don't have a problem with it.
I completely disagree, but we'll get to that later.
I would like to hear opposing thoughts. I really have trouble with the first half, so I was looking forward to hear what everybody else thought.
All right. Well, I've got something I want to get out before the spoiler flag, then I think we need to get the spoiler flag up so we can get into it.
I just wanted to say one thing about Chrissy's in response, which is I agree with her that the first 10 minutes was kind of pretentious and whatnot, where, you know,
but it's fucking beautiful,
but the next 50 minutes I didn't feel was pretentious, so I can agree with Dan on that, but we'll get into that. So Eric, what are you gonna say?
All right, so I want to talk a little bit about the music, which we can talk about before the spoiler flag.
Wagner,
yes. And when Dan and I were talking about this, when we were discussing him coming on the podcast, Dan mentioned something that a friend of his had said to him about this particular piece of music, but he couldn't quite remember the details. And I said to Dan, I bet that's something my dad would know. So I'm going to – so my dad is a music professor. So I'm going to read you the email that I sent to my father and then his response that I got less than 7 hours later. So I sent him an email and said, "Hi, Dad. I have a music theory related question for you. We are going to be discussing a movie called Melancholia on Dark Discussions, and Dan was telling me that a friend of his told him something about the music used in the opening sequence of the movie. It's Tristan und Isolde by Wagner. And according to Dan's friend, maybe he can't quite remember, it's taught in music theory classes because it doesn't have a key signature. Does that sound right to you? Do you have any idea what he's talking about? So
Dan said Isolde, I think, right, Dan?
Yeah, Isolde.
Isolde. Is that not what I said?
You said the same. I used to do the same as me and said Isolde.
So. Oh, whatever.
Yeah, yeah, we're not German, so.
Yeah, stop being a Nazi, Phil.
What do you call it? A grammar Nazi.
So, my dad's response, and I would put money that he didn't have to look this up. So my dad's response is, the short answer is yes. The long answer, the cellos play A flat, F, E, and then D sharp in a chord that has G sharp above, F, and B below. This is now known as the Tristan chord. It is actually a half diminished chord on E sharp, but Wagner spells it F, G sharp, B, D sharp. The oboe takes over the G sharp on type voice, goes up chromatically to A, then A sharp harmonized by E, G sharp, D in the three lower voices. Then the oboe goes up one more half step to complete a dominant seventh chord on E, which ordinarily would resolve to A major. Instead, Wagner repeats the whole sequence a third higher, cellos, B, G sharp, G, F sharp, harmonized by B above, G sharp, D below, half diminished chord on G sharp, oboe up to C, G sharp, harmonized by G, B, F, oboe sliding up to D to complete a dominant 7 on G, which would ordinarily resolve to C major. The cellos then start on D, B as though the same thing were going to happen a third time, but Wagner goes elsewhere. So yes, there is no key signature. Yes, Wagner is playing with our sense of key by never resolving anything expectedly. This is an early example of atonality where the listener cannot perceive the music in any given key, thus no key signature. The chords are not so unusual, just the spacing of the voices. The half diminished seventh chord has to be spaced exactly this way to be the Tristan chord, and the slithering sequence of chords that defies expectation. You said it's already in the second half of the 19th century was easing away from key-centered tonality. Tristan is just the most famous example. I love you. I love it when you give me musical problems that I know how to answer.
Wagner rules. That's basically what your father is basically saying.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I sent this to Dan, and Dan responded, "That's cool. I like feeling dumb sometimes."
Well, your father could have just been polite and said, "Richard Wagner is awesome," and that would be it.
Yeah, this is what he's been studying for 55 years.
Exactly.
My housemate, Charles, first of all, is a musician, and he is absolutely going to love this episode and probably know exactly what your dad is talking about. I think it's very interesting, though, because what it reveals is that this piece of music was clearly chosen to support the single effect of the film, mm-hmm. which is the impact of the unexpected. These are all characters that really do not have any idea what is about to happen with them. Similarly, Justine her behavior is always unexpected, mm-hmm. right? Nobody really knows when she's going to flip out or, you know, how she's going to react. She can't really control things. So I think it's interesting that they particularly chose that one and that your dad brought that up, because that to me immediately clicked the second you read that thing about the atonality and mm-hmm. the unexpected. I was like, okay, that makes total sense. And also, as far as atonal goes, none of these characters, at least in the first half, really get along with each other. That kind of supports that too. So I'm happy I got my single effect comment in tonight. Now I don't have to do another one later.
Chris, you mentioned a couple times, and I wouldn't disagree that Justine has an illness, and we can discuss that it's a behavioral health illness. But obviously she's engaged and is getting married and whatnot. So it's not total debilitating. So my question to you is, did you think, I mean, obviously we find out by the end that, you know, everything goes to chaos and she, well, you know, we'll explain what she does. But prior to that, did you really think her behavioral health issue was as bad as at first as how you were making it sound, or were you just saying that she just has a behavioral health issue? I'm not quite sure how you were referring.
Oh no, clearly there was an exchange in the first, I don't know, after the sequence in the beginning, and they're at the wedding. They actually get to the wedding, and there's something someone says that really made it clear to me that this was actually very severe. The sister says to her, "We agreed." That's what it was. "We agreed that we didn't want any scenes."
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that right there, I went, okay, she is definitely suffering from an extreme form of probably bipolar, or, I mean, I know they call it there is an actual disorder called melancholia. I'm not sure what the difference is between melancholia and
bipolar. Be depression. Because I
think melancholia is like an old timey term for depression.
I don't think so.
No? Yes. You think it's something different?
Different. I think it's different.
I think melancholia is a form of depression that is hallmarked by a sense that you are doomed.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's why they would have chosen melancholia instead of bipolar disorder. Because melancholia better supports, here we go again, the single effect of the film.
Right. My term, I would probably call it dysthymia rather than bipolar, because I mean the highs and lows. It was more like Dan said. It was more like a doom that was always around her. So that's why I would say dysthymia instead of bipolar. But continue, Chris. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, that's totally okay. I just knew that it was some form of massive. Massive depression, and I did not get a chance to look up melancholia versus the bipolar or whatever, but I know that melancholia is also related. This I just know because I've just been through some stuff recently. It is also connected to concealed depression, which is connected to what's that other disorder? Borderline personality disorder. And concealed depression and borderline personality disorder, in some cases, a lot of people suffer, like a lot of artists and geniuses, quote, suffer from concealed depression. And that's kind of when I got the clue later that it was more melancholia and not bipolar, just because she's talking about this tagline and they're saying to her, "Oh, you're so brilliant. You're working even on the day of your wedding. Well, your mind is turning." So I thought, oh, she might have been a little bit of genius, you know.
I think we need to throw out the spoiler flag so we can get into it.
Eric, before we do that, I have to say this is a melancholia and the infinite sadness.
Okay.
The world is a vampire.
The world is a vampire.
Is a vampire.
Is that Taylor Swift or something?
No, it's Smashing Pumpkins. It's the name of their album, Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness. And then I assumed Eric would know because
Smashing Pumpkins, you said?
Yeah, it's not really like it's not metal, is it? It doesn't count. It's not music.
Alternative metal.
Yeah, it means it's not music.
Well, it's pretty good. You got to listen to some of this stuff.
No, we don't.
they ruled. They were my favorite alternative grunge band of the 90s, 2000, whatever that was. All right, I thought you guys would get my joke, but you didn't.
No. All I know about Smashing Pumpkins is that Weird Al parodied one of their songs.
Gotcha. But, yeah,
and they never actually smashed a pumpkin,
which is bullshit.
Though when they spelled the title "Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness," they wrote "Melon and Collie."
Right.
Anyway, okay, so let's throw up the spoiler part, and I'll start my lame Smashing Pumpkin references, and we can get into everything and anything about this film. So spoilers Alert.
Spoilers abound!
If you haven't seen this film and you don't want to be spoiled, please shut off now and come back later. If you do want to watch this film, it's available anywhere on VOD. It's available on disc, both Blu-ray and DVD. And you can actually watch it for free with commercials on Vudu if you didn't want to rent it. So you just have to open a Vudu account, which is free.
I would personally recommend watching this movie without commercial interruption.
Right, and the Blu-ray is phenomenal. I think on Eric's 4K TV.
Oh, it looks gorgeous. Yeah.
All right, so here we are. So what do we want to talk about? How do we want to begin and whatnot? Anyone?
Well, I think...
go ahead, Dan.
All right, so I think we got to talk about the opening sequence.
Okay.
Right? Because I think to some people that seems relatively...
say what?
Not connected or sort of pointless. But there's a lot of information in that sort of sets up where this is going. And using Wagner in this particular piece in that way is important. So that piece of music, none of the chords ever resolve the way you would anticipate them to. And yet it's an incredibly beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm.
So what that is in my mind foreshadowing is that this event is nothing's going to resolve in this movie the way you want it to, but it will be beautiful. So it's just like a heads up that this is coming, and that whole piece of music kind of, you can't play an excerpt from that music. So I was happy that it was the whole thing that was there. And I think it gets some big things out of the way right away. It lets us know exactly what's going to happen. So we don't have to worry about that. We can watch how the characters deal with it.
And it kind of previews the whole movie, although in many spots symbolically. You know, you do see her trying to escape her wedding dress. You see the actual end where the planets collide. It's all previewed to that in the opening sequence.
Yeah.
One thing I did read, because after I watched the movie last night, I went about looking for symbolisms and all that other stuff. And there's one scene in that prelude or pre whatever it's called.
I think prelude is the right word.
Yeah, prelude, I thought was. Where she, meaning Justine, is walking in the wedding dress and like she's being pulled back by the earth. Mm-hmm. And
I actually think that's supposed to be wool.
Wool?
Yeah, it's heavy wool.
Okay, interesting. Because and what I read about that was that she was supposed to represent something to do with the earth, and then when she states in the second part that she knows things like almost as part of the earth, I guess that was like supposed to represent that, I guess, but I don't know. Since we're just talking about certain things at the beginning, I figured I'd throw that out.
Yeah, I think there's a scene where she's talking with her sister where she talks about how she feels like she's walking in her gown surrounded by wool being dragged down.
Yeah, she does say that at one point.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, there you go. So I'll take that word over the critic who wrote the other thing. But
yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's in theory partly a flash forward, because you know when she puts her hands up and the lightning is going through her fingers and the birds are falling and stuff, I was and the way she's dressed I think was the same as how she was dressed at the very end of the film. However, as we note, she's also in her wedding dress at points in this prelude as well, so it's a mixture of all sorts of things. It's not just a flash forward.
Well, and there is an image in the beginning too, I believe, where we see ash falling, if I'm not mistaken, and there's a couple of references to ash, which is sort of like she talks about trudging through the gray woolly yard. That was what you guys were talking about.
Yeah.
But also when she eats the meatloaf later in the second half, it like tastes like ash to her. And I think what that ash symbolizes is she can't feel, like she's so ill that her life, she is not connected to the outside world. I have had some experience with depression on a massive level, like a really bad level, like where you are just completely disengaged from the world around you. You know, you don't want to eat because food just honestly doesn't taste good. You don't want to do anything. You don't want to, I mean, think about that. You don't want to get dressed. You don't want to shower. You don't want to. So I think the ash is symbolic of how ill she is, that even if she wanted to engage in this privileged world that she is in, she really can't. She doesn't have the ability to.
And I want to touch on that because that's actually the first part of the movie is what really connected me to this movie, because I have suffered from depression myself, and not quite to the extent as portrayed in this movie. But I thought Kirsten Dunst was brilliant in portraying that. And there's one sequence in particular later on when she has one of the confrontations with her sister. Her sister says something like, you said you were going to try, or you, and she was like, I am. And Kirsten Dunst says something like, I keep smiling and smiling and smiling. And her sister yells at you, you lied to us. And that particular sequence of the movie really connected with me, because when you suffer from depression, as I have periodically throughout my life, you learn that people don't want to deal with it. And if you show how you're really feeling, nobody wants to be around you. And so you put on that fake smile and try and pretend to be happy when you're not. And then when people find out that you're still unhappy, they get mad at you for it, and it's fucked up. And it's 'cause like people get mad at you for not being happy. And it's like, well, don't you fucking think I actually like to be happy? But yeah, it's something you don't have control over. And so that particular sequence of the movie really connected with me.
Yeah. And I would agree. I, Eric, have been in places that were almost as bad as Kirsten Dunst. And so that scene really connected with me. And that was the scene that she really impressed me and blew me away, because I said, oh my God, okay, well, I've actually been that bad a couple times in my life. And she looks exactly probably the way that I looked.
Well, you know, where she deserves all the accolades she gets for playing.
She really does. Where you just, it's so bad. I remember feeling it on my face, like being like, I can't, I am so sad and so disconnected that I am wearing this on my skin. And even if I did smile, it doesn't matter. It doesn't feel like anything. It just wouldn't even look like a smile. Like there's this weird, like, when you get that deep into it, there's this very strange, it's like you can wear it on your skin. And that's why that what you said, Eric, where she's like, I keep smiling and smiling and smiling. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what that said to me, because mm-hmm. I was like, oh my God, I know exactly. It's not necessarily, yes, I'm depressed, I have to force myself to smile. It's when you go down that hole so low that you can't get out, that the smile is actually like, you don't even feel it, even if you're forcing it. Mm-hmm. You feel like you're not doing it. It's oh God, it's so hard to explain. Yeah,
depression sucks.
It really does. And the thing is that I truly believe that everyone in his or her lifetime experiences a form of very severe depression at least once or twice. And, you know, you look at, for example, someone who is widowed and has lost the love of their lives. That is a moment of intense depression. Everyone does it. And that's why it's so interesting that, like you were talking about, people judge you for it. Everyone in his lifetime is going to run into this situation. I have never met anyone that has encountered a loss of something very important to them and has not gone down a very bad rabbit hole. Maybe not for days, maybe not for weeks, but, you know, for hours. You know what I mean? Like, it happens. And it is not necessarily a disorder. Like, sometimes it's just normal. People just go through it.
Well,
you know?
I think this is much different than that, though. I think this is more the artist's depression. In other words, she sees things more clearly, similar to, like, an artist sees things more clearly. And as a result, she is depressed about being. So,
well, yeah, I mean, she catastrophizes. So that's an art. That's concealed depression, catastrophizing.
Yeah. So I think, you know, it's not because someone passed or a parent divorced or anything like that. I think it's just she sees the world for what it is. In other words, and she's also not being helped. You know, it's like everybody's looking at about their own self and how they are looked at by everybody, and no one's asking her, how are you feeling? And so it's a combination of those things rather than a specific thing in life that has made her melancholy.
Well, and I don't think Chrissy was trying to apply that to the character. She was just
talking about depression
in general.
I was just talking about it in general. But, like, with this kind of depression that you're talking about, Phil, you said artist depression. She sees the world differently, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so they're often really talented and really expressive. I'm talking about concealed depression, which is probably related to melancholia, I'm guessing. They look for purpose all the time. They're always having existential crises. They will make muted cries for help, which she kind of does in that one moment with her husband. And he says, I'm sorry, I haven't been taking care of you. You know, even though he's kind of a gormless dude and you get the sense he doesn't really get it. They interpret substances differently. Like, they know when they should drink and when they should not drink to make it worse or better, or how to manage that. They have a very evolved and involved perception of life and death. They're very comfortable talking about death. They have strange eating habits. There's that thing where she says, I didn't even eat anything. Like, randomly, she goes, I didn't even eat anything. They don't sleep normally. They usually have abandonment issues. They're professionals at covering up. They always are working so hard to seem happy so nobody will figure it out. All they want is love and acceptance. They can't shut down their brains. They hurt when others hurt. You know, like when Stellan Skarsgård, that moment with the onion soup, and he says right in front of the kid, well, poor Tim, the kid who's standing there, got fired today. And she gets pissed off and basically says, you know what? Let me tell you what an asshole I think you are, pretty much. Because she's pissed at him because he hurt
that
the
awesome.
Kid. Yeah, that was really awesome. And they catastrophize. They think of worst case scenarios. And
Dan, are you still there?
Sorry,
I'll totally shut up. If I'm totally got to shut up and let other people talk, Dan's a guest. But anyway, move on. I'm done. That's all I wanted to share.
Oh, so I do have a little input on the depression thing.
Okay.
One, I think that's one of Lars von Trier's skills, is dealing with things on multiple levels. And part of where I'm maybe a little bit better off is my undergrad degree is in philosophy. So a lot of I've read a lot of the stuff that this movie references. And there's two levels. There's this depression level that, and it's very real, the way he wants you to, like, feel it and understand how hard it can be. But on another level, she's kind of acting as like the protagonist for nihilism. So she's she sees the banality in everything. And that begins at the very beginning when they can't get the limousine down the driveway. Mm-hmm. It's this frustrating thing to watch this car. And it's like trying to do things the normal way just isn't working. And the film is like just replete with that. And she understands all of it. Like, she guesses the number of beans in the jar. She knows that number. She knows that the planet's coming before anybody else. She is like really in tune with the idea that life is basically meaningless. And everything around her is all these rules that she's trying to sort of aggressively lash out against. And that's why depression works so well to highlight that.
Let me just interject 1 second and then continue, which is a good example, and it comes pretty quick after the limousine episode when the waiter or the person that works for the wedding planner comes over to her and says, left to right, you pass the food. You know, counterclockwise, you don't pass the food. You know, and this guy had the nerve to tell the bride that. And,
right.
And these are just stupid little rules that don't mean anything in the real world. And she, like, sees them for what they are rather than, you know, some sort of etiquette or some other thing that is a man-made concept. But continue, Dan.
Right. So ultimately, I think what this movie gets at is there's three big personality types that are sort of confronted with this scenario. You have Justine, who is like the self-absorbed, depression-suffering nihilist. You have her sister, Claire, who's like a neurotic. And you have Claire's husband, who's overly rational and trusting in systems. And none of them are really equipped to deal with what's coming. And that those basic human archetypes all sort of fall apart in the face of the realization that life is meaningless, but ultimately beautiful.
And that's a fair point because, throughout the film, I could relate mostly, I guess, to Kirsten Dunst's character because I've always been the brooding melancholy type anyway. But the person that I like the most after her would be Kiefer Sutherland's character because he tried to be positive generally. I mean, obviously he was a bit upset about spending all this money for, you know, and it was going badly for the wedding. But generally he was trying to keep everybody else, centered. And unfortunately at the very end when they needed him the most, this is when his character kind of changes, and that comes down to exactly what you said, Dan, which is he was unprepared for the worst case scenario. If he had been prepared, he would have stayed with his family to the very end and kept them centered as much as he could. And oddly, the person that kept the people centered, or at least the young ones centered, the nephew was oddly the nihilist in Kirsten Dunst, even though she was kind of not too helpful to
her
sister.
Well, at the end, like that's when she builds the thing for them to sit in, she helps him whittle that thing, call it a tent or a fort or whatever it is. You know, that's like her one compassionate act. That's her one selfless act. Right. So the end is coming. And now
she was kind to the boy during the wedding, too. Right.
Well, kind. Yes. But not selfless. Because he would ask her, when are we going to do this? And she would always blow him off. And at the end, she finally does the selfless act and helps him at this moment when the world that she knew and what she knew to be true was actually coming to fruition with everybody else. That's when she is able to finally act compassionately to another person. That's my take on it.
Right,
anyway.
Yeah, totally. Because then she can actually connect, whereas her extreme depression disconnected her. She's finally connected to humanity.
Because
she can relate to everything that's happening.
Right.
No, and that's a fair point. That's a fair point because, like, for example, when I said dysthymia, I felt she was more like than anything else, which is basically mass depression, low self-esteem, obviously things like either insomnia or overtired, and in this case, she was very overtired. And then, what was the other thing that it was? Hopelessness, feeling of hopelessness. But again, once everybody comes down to her opinion, or her, in other words, knows the truth, her dysthymia doesn't hamper her anymore, because now she is the norm, I guess, and everybody else is dealing with something that I guess she's always dealt with. Well, even though they weren't going to die, no one was going to die until the planet hit, she was always dying inside anyway. But go on, Eric.
Well, and also the whole thing, even though it's the story of the movie, is also symbolic about this planet, which they name Melancholia. It passes by and then swings back and comes back around and ultimately destroys everything.
Yeah, the Earth's gravity pulls it back.
So it's even though it's an actual plot device of the movie where it ends up destroying everything at the end, it's also, you know, a symbolic of the depression, which will swing by and get further away and then come back again and destroy everything.
Yeah, and if you look at it that way, the movie is massively depressing, to be honest. Because, but I mean, to be honest, I mean, the world ends, and that's how it ends. So obviously, it's not happy. But oddly, you feel a little hope even at the end. I do anyway, even though the world dies, because you know some people like the nephew and even Justine are at least at peace. So there's at least felt some little hope. But the way you put it, Eric. Where the planet that hits Earth is actually a symbol of depression or dysthymia or whatever, then it doesn't really feel like a happy ending.
It's not a happy ending. Everything dies.
Well, what is kind of cool too is that I was watching it on Amazon. So they have that little X-ray thing on Amazon, which tends to annoy me a lot, but for really,
I don't even know what this X-ray is.
Okay. It's a little thing on the side of your Amazon Prime. If you're watching on your computer and it says X-ray, and if you click on it, it will give you while you're watching the movie, who's in that particular scene. It might have a trivia fact. It'll tell you what song is playing. All right.
Yeah, I've seen those on discs, the Game of Thrones.
Well, so just so you're aware, if you're using the Amazon Prime app on your Apple TV, you can initiate that feature just by lightly touching the touchpad on your remote.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
But it has often been extremely freaking annoying. Because it just will pop up sometimes, and I'm like, what the hell? What is it doing there? Well, I actually turned this on a couple times during the movie because I was just seeing if there was anything interesting. And lo and behold, I found a lot of cool stuff about fact errors regarding the approach of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
So then I had to leave the damn thing on because every couple scenes it would come up with some other interesting thing. And one of the things it said, you know, when the electricity goes out, one of the things it said was that a planet approaching Earth in reality would not cause electricity problems. But what would happen, which is never mentioned, is there would be probably a lot of earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, and tsunamis, which would probably destroy a lot of shit before that planet even hit. And I thought that was so cool. But there was a bunch of them like that. Like they talk about how there's a thing where Claire looks at the picture of the solar, the planet's path.
Yes.
And they're like, that's totally wrong. The X-ray thing was like, that's totally not right.
Well, and that's why I was pointing it out that it's a plot device, but it's also symbolic. Because you're right. That's not like physics contradict that drawing.
Right. Well, I mean, if the moon can just move waves to the point there's a high tide and low tide, you figure a planet like this would cause exactly all those terrible things that you said.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right. Well, and here's the other thing, too. It's like there was a moment also in the fact error. I just started having so much fun with these fact error things because I'm really into this, planets and stuff like that. But an object coming from behind the sun would never be hidden. It would always be in full view. But I thought that maybe the director had done that purposely because Justine is never out in the sun. She is always really hiding inside herself. So I didn't necessarily think that was a fact error. I kind of was like, oh, he's just messing with it to make another, like, really cool connection.
Well, I was going to say, they're treating this like it's a piece of science fiction based in reality when I don't think it's meant to be.
No, it's not.
No, this
is not
meant to be art. And there's no way Lars von Trier even thought about how a planet would act.
Oh, I'm sure he did.
He did not give a shit. Like, he just doesn't. The guy drinks a half a gallon of vodka before lunch. He did not give a shit about
No, and I would agree, and I don't have a problem with the movie because of that at all. I just wanted to bring it up because I thought it was fascinating. I was like, oh my God, that's really cool. Really? Like, I didn't know that. Like, you know, so that was just very interesting. So I definitely wanted to share them. I didn't write them all down.
Well,
but,
and if you go to the Wikipedia page for the movie, they actually have that drawing of the path of Melancholia. And it just doesn't make any sense at all.
Oh, no, it totally doesn't.
it really doesn't.
I'm completely in agreement with Dan. This was not supposed to be a scientifically accurate film by any stretch. I just found it interesting that somebody somewhere who writes these X-ray things took the time to, like, write up all that shit and put it in there just in case you were curious. Like,
right.
I don't
right.
know. It was kind
it's
of fun.
Fun job.
Yeah.
I would love that job, except I'd be having 50 million X-ray things all through the movie.
Yes.
People would really hate
you.
Me.
Phil.
Yes.
I haven't heard from you in a while.
Oh, right. Well, no, I mean, I had read in a lot of my readings last night that obviously, and I heard it from Von Trier specifically, that he wasn't trying to be factually correct, and that obviously the planet and its impact were more symbolism. I mean, he comes right out and says, yeah, this is a symbolic film. So those things never really bothered me. I mean, the moment you see the planet coming close and it's not pulling the land like it would pulls the water. I figure you kind of get that. So it's similar to like we talked about Witchboard last week where we said can she crack through the glass of the bathtub, and you go with it because it's this is movie logic, like with the whiskey bottle
that we
discussed. So I didn't really pay much attention to those things, honestly. I was more interested in the characters and what was going on.
I have a question about something that happened in this movie that didn't make, like, I'm sure he put it in there intentionally, and I'm sure he did it for a reason. I've been unable to determine what the reason is. I'm wondering if anybody can clue me in, which is there are two times in the movie when Kirsten Dunst is riding her horse and the horse refuses to cross over the river.
Yeah, that bridge.
Does anybody know what that's about?
Yes. I read about it that the bridge and if you notice the car. I mean, the golf cart stops right at the bridge as well. When Claire and her son are trying to cross, it stops. So there's something about that bridge that won't let people go through. And I think Dan's going to explain that to us right now.
So what? I don't know. Explain it. This is probably not the right word. But what I take from that is, first of all, they're in an incredibly idyllic setting, right? Mm-hmm. I think in any circumstance, most people would look at that kind of setting and lifestyle with a little bit of envy.
Absolutely.
And so it's this idyllic circumstance that is basically, again, I'm going to use this word a lot, basically meaningless in terms of existence. And for that reason, nothing goes outside of that, because outside of that is essentially nothing. That's where, like, reason breaks down. So that would be my take on it. Like, that the horse is smart enough to know that this is as ideal as it gets, and that it's false to go anywhere else.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of that movie, The Others, with Nicole Kidman, Eric, where Nicole Kidman's is a spoiler alert. Nicole, yeah. So she's in this mansion similar to this mansion here, and she tries to leave, and it won't let her leave because the fog comes, and then she just gets lost, and when she has to turn it back, and it kind of reminded me of that where what Dan was saying, that the area they're in is the life they have, and this is the life that the existence has given them, and they can't leave it. So the only, you know, I mean, you, if Kirsten Dunst, technically you could say a wealthy Silver Spoon child could just, you know, pack it up and move to Montana and disappear off the face of the earth. But it's not as easy as it sounds.
No, you can never escape your past.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, and so the Silver Spoon person, which is these people here that want to escape, they just can't. It's always going to follow them no matter what. And I think that's partly what it symbolizes too, because technically they could leave, and
why would they?
Well, this is the thing is that I remember, you know, when I was a kid, I go, all right, I'm depressed. I want to get the hell out of here. I should move to Seattle, or I should move to, you know, Minneapolis or wherever. But I dated enough girls that came to Boston for college, and you find out that the reason they came, a lot of them, not all of them, but a number of them came because they just wanted to leave their past because they were depressed where they were. Unfortunately, what happens is you're still the same person, even if you're in a different city, and you're still depressed. You're still the same. Everything's the same. So you have to change your self. It's not
because wherever you go, there you are.
Exactly. So, and I think that's partly what he's trying to say here, is that they have to change themselves before they can actually leave.
Well, and I would even add another level to that. And this is one of those cool things that I always talk about, where there's no real wrong way to interpret something. Each thing that you guys have said can all be part of the bridge. But I think the bridge also means, to me, on a very surface level, it said that the bridge, like you said, was a connection to the outside world, but they can't connect with others. Again, it was a reference back to the two sisters kind of being a microcosm, where Justine is really depressed and Claire is the neurotic caretaker, and that they cannot connect with other people in the outside world because they are so self-involved.
So I think it's meant to enhance or rather highlight their isolation from everyone.
A bunch
else.
Of stuff. All the stuff you guys said makes total sense. Like, I think it just depends on, again, when you're a viewer, you bring your own experience to the film. So when you're trying to interpret something like a bridge, like we are, it's really cool because that bridge said something a little different to each of us, depending on what life experience we bring to the film with us when we see it. And dear listeners, Dark Discussions apologizes if you have not seen The Others. Phil just ruined the whole film for you. Email to darkdiscussions@AOL.com.
You'll have to bleep that out, Phil.
Yeah, because someone,
my joke won't work.
Madison Bosworth, an Australian listener, kind of ripped our podcast for talking about the Ranger in our Annabelle episode, and that we
I don't remember that.
Yeah, I don't either. So,
you know, I think it's impossible, honestly, when we are in this type of a round table discussion, I really think it's impossible to just not reference other films and not really stop and think about it. Like, I kind of don't think that's a fair, you know, we're sitting around talking, like, with our coffee or our beer, whatever.
I think it's fair, but we don't do it to be mean.
We don't do it, no.
You should.
I mean, I think we should all start policing ourselves and be like, wait a minute, I can't talk about that. Like, you know, I don't know.
Right. I mean, the difference is The Others is you know, what, 12 years?
Oh, it's way old. No, it's older than that. It's like, it's got to be almost 20 years old, right?
Right.
Well, yeah, that's, what, 96? Right.
Yeah. And then the Ranger is only, you know, less than a year.
No, if we spoiled the Ranger inadvertently, I apologize. Wasn't intentional.
Yeah, that's what I wrote.
Sorry. I don't even know what you guys are talking about.
Yeah, I mentioned that on Facebook.
It was 2001. I got my date off. It was the others.
Oh, there you go. So 18 years old.
18 years old, yeah. It's pretty old.
So 20, almost 20 years old, yeah. All right, so anyway, back to this. I can bleep out the little spoiler I said. I'll use the record scratch sound.
There you go.
So the bridge was a curiosity, and again, that was one of those things that was I guess obviously of a symbolism.
I think both those bridge incidents are spurred on by Claire's neuroticism.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just basically when it involves Justine, it's just not going to happen. Like, you're however neurotic you are, it's not going to work your way.
Dan, can you give me a definition for the layman? Because I'm familiar with the term, but I don't know the actual symptoms and what it means. Neurotic, what does that mean exactly?
Rather than just going with a straight up definition, it's just someone who is super uptight and everything has to be in order.
Gotcha.
And everything has to make sense. And things have to progress in certain ways. So her worldview is becoming
like that.
Maybe her worldview is becoming completely undone. Right? It's almost as if Justine wants to talk about technology when we're in music.
That bitch.
Right. No, and that's a fair point because honestly. I think in a time when this occurs, a lot of people who aren't even neurotic would become neurotic or show signs of neuroticism because everything you know that was happened a week ago is now about to end. You know, I mean, and it's not like, you know, if it's a world war or something like that, nuclear war, you know, people panic, whatever. But that's man-made. Here, this is just flat-out fluke. And everything that she knows, and there's no escape, and you know she can't just.
I might panic
it.
Too.
Yeah, yeah.
But here's the most upsetting scene in this movie to me. I like when everybody dies at the end. That's cool. The most upsetting scene to me in this movie is when she starts whipping the horse. I was not cool with that at all. Yeah.
Yeah.
That upset
well,
me.
Well, it upset me a whole lot as well because, you know, anytime there's violence to animals, it bothers me tremendously. However, as Chrissy has mentioned and Dan has mentioned, Justine unfortunately has a behavioral health issues. And so at least I couldn't blame her 100% because it's part of her mental illness. But it was upsetting, yes. I mean, the best scene was when Justine says, "Oh, the Earth deserves to die."
That was the Earth is evil. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, that was one. So Justine does the worst and the best scene in the film. Again, though, if we look at it logically, and her being illogical, I don't think she was doing it because she was evil. I think she was doing it because she was mentally ill.
No, well, but still, that's whipping a horse. It's not cool.
You're damn right it's not cool, Eric. I'm just trying to put a perspective on.
Okay. What were you saying, Ben?
Well, that's like that part where she talks about the Earth deserving to die. There's like two facets to her. There's like this aggressive sort of part that is like attacking things that are seen as the norm. Sometimes even attacking like the what she represents. And then there's this passive one that's like, well, the Earth just deserves it. This is where we're going. Like, that's really melancholia, right? Like, that end sort of, like, doom fate thing is where that's coming through. But I think one of the – and this is because I have access to art people. But there's the scene in the where she's in the library and she's pulling the plate – the books that are displaying art plates – out and switching them.
Right.
So
right.
She the plates she's pulling out are by an artist whose last name is Malevich. He's a Russian artist. And it's like he coined the term. I want to say it's called suprematism or suprematism. And then he started out as a cubist, and the idea between like that art is that cubism was like that's sort of like the ultimate geometrical shape. And then his art went and said, incorporated, no, there is no like geometric shape that is supreme over others. All geometric shapes have their own sort of supremacy. And basically, kind of like
Wagner's music. In a
well,
sense.
Kind of, yeah, well, exactly. Like, so the he gets to this point in his career where he just says, like, nothing really has meaning. We're attributing too much meaning to things. Nothing has meaning. And that's sort of where that artistic movement goes. So she takes out all those plates and replaces them with like pre-Renaissance paintings. And one is the first painting that we see that gets destroyed at the beginning, the winter scene.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, I think that's called Hunters in the Snow. And the other is Caravaggio's David and Goliath, which are both pre-Renaissance things where there was sort of like this simple belief in the mysticism of the world and rather than this like complex philosophical system that deals with it. So it's weird because she sort of represents that complex philosophical system, but she removes the artwork that is representative of that body of work and replaces it with something much simpler.
Well,
I found that fascinating.
That makes sense, Dan. And the reason I can see everything you just said was because she was the one that kind of laughs at the etiquette and the things yes. that you have to do, you know, at the wedding and all this other stuff. Because the wedding planner they bring in, played by Udo Kerr, is like very strict and so it's not like free flowing. So in other words, you know, it's not like a hippie wedding or people just doing it in their backyard type of wedding. And I think she can see somewhere in between. And that's what's interesting because what you said, how she's very complex and whatnot. And yet she also is simple. It's like, why can't you pass the food to the clockwise instead of counterclockwise? It shouldn't matter.
Right.
And so she's somewhere in the middle and isn't an extremist in a sense when it comes to logic. And I think that is another reason why she sees things more clearly than everybody else, because everybody else, like the sister, and based off the definition of neuroticism, as you said, needs everything in order and all this and whatever. And then the sister's husband is the person that is trying to make everything centered and make sure everybody is on track and whatnot. And yet she's, meaning Justine, is somewhere in the middle saying, you know what, you can just take a break, take a breath, and just look at things and do what you would do naturally instead of these fake rules and stuff. I mean, I may be overthinking stuff, but everything you kind of said makes sense, especially since she's a contradiction in herself.
Right. And I would say, I don't know that I would attribute, there's obviously a certain kind of logic to her, but I think it's more of like, she's more of an intuit. Like everything is just intuitive to her and the rules that are getting applied don't make sense. The other part that I think is interesting is how he sort of like sets up this idea of like, sort
when
of banality.
You mean
Lars von Trier? Yeah, the idea of like banality, and then the ultimate sort of end, and that's represented at that wedding dinner, which is a really uncomfortable event. And they have her father, who is like putting the silver spoons,
yeah,
and like baking, sealing them. He's trying to be funny. And he's not, right? So it's like this attempt at levity. It's basically von Trier saying, like, there's going to be no levity in this. Like, this is the one attempt at levity, and it fails fucking horribly. And then,
go ahead.
Then the mother is the exact opposite, and she says, enjoy it while it lasts. So she's foreshadowing, like, this is the end, right? And he's trying to make light of it, but it's failing. I thought that was pretty brilliant.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's a good point, because the mother is the fatalist and,
right.
and pretty much a prick, and the father is
a womanizer.
Not a Nazi.
Come to think of it, nobody in this movie is likable.
at least, the father is at least, if not a narcissist, he's at least self-centered. And, you know, because he has the three Betsies or whatever they were that
Betty's.
Betty's. And he made sure that they were all different shapes and sizes. So you know, he got the best
of everything. As one does.
Yes, as one does. And yet, he is levity. He's everything. The world is stupid, and I'm going to have levity with the world. However, he goes too far. And so both the mother and the father are way too far. And if it's surprising that either daughter survives, you know, they're not landing up in a mental institution because of those parents.
Well, especially him, when his daughter actually needs the actual levity, that he seems to be the person that can somehow provide it. He disappears.
Because she asks. And he says, help in the morning. And it makes sense. You know, okay, it's late because, I mean, this wedding, they were cutting the cake at 11 o'clock at night, right?
11:30. Well, that's because they were like 2 hours late.
Because the limo couldn't get up the driveway. So the problem was is that you have the guys dead tired. So you figure, okay, fine, in the morning we can talk. However, he leaves with the chicks because he couldn't take no for you know, in other words, the chicks were basically offering themselves to him. He says, I got a good deal here, I had to take it. And that's basically what he wrote in the letter. So, you know, and then he leaves her behind, and again she's left alone, and you're absolutely right. So she's crying for help without saying I need help, because she's just hoping people will not be self-centered. And the one person who you would think would help, the guy that doesn't take anything seriously, doesn't even help. And that's unfortunate.
Right. And that's significant in that this is like her wedding night and the end of her marriage all in one night.
Right.
Yeah. So. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's not only the end of her marriage, but it's the end, you could argue, of her living a life of norm.
I mean, depending on if
your definition of a normal life is married with children and a good job, and she would have had all that.
Well, she's never going to get that.
Exactly.
So I think that's the statement because she recognizes the banality of existence and the meaninglessness of existence, she can't have any sense of normalcy.
Right. And again, so this has nothing to do with man and woman roles, because she's making huge money in the job she has. So she just throws everything away in one night, including her job, because she gets fired and quits her job that night. She just becomes
after she fucks the guy that gets fired.
So she is
actively destroying her chance at quote unquote normalcy.
Yes.
Right.
One of my favorite moments in the whole movie is when she tells off her boss, and her boss gets super pissed and throws his plate. And it just bounces off. So he goes over and he goes, excuse me. And he picks it up and comes back over and then deliberately smashes it.
Yeah.
That made me laugh.
But before he smashes it, he goes, oh, I chipped my plate or something like that.
Yeah.
This moment is actually not connected to anything, but I just wanted to mention it because I just cracked up. I loved it when Kiefer Sullivan goes up to the room and he packs up all his wife's shit and he brings it outside and dumps it.
That wasn't his wife. It was his mother-in-law.
It wasn't his mother-in-law. Yeah, it was somebody. And then he picks it all up and then he brings it back in the house. And then he goes to his wife and he says, oh, I just tried to throw your mother out again. She says something like, oh, I'm not surprised or whatever.
Yeah.
Did he say, like, she said, oh, you've done that before? It's like, I don't know. That little section to me was just really funny.
Sutherland was being such an ass during the wedding and reception because he spent a lot of money on it. I get it. But at the same time, he's just being such a douche about it. He's just like, and he just like flat out, do you have any idea how much I spent on this? It's like, that's not something you say out loud, jackass.
You know why I think he finally just snapped, and even though it wasn't the right thing to say, I don't think he was a dink. And the reason I say that
he was absolutely a dink.
Well, yeah, but I think it was more just finally snapping, and I'll tell you why. Because he has the wedding planner being a dink to him, saying, "You got to do this. This is ridiculous. This is terrible. You guys aren't following the rule." And he's dealing with that. Then he has his mother-in-law, who's a fucking asshole, and then he has his father-in-law, who's embarrassing him with three Bettys, and then the bride keeps on disappearing, and people are asking him where she is. You know. So I mean, if that was me, even if I wasn't spending the money, I'm hosting the wedding, and all this shit is falling onto my, and I'm the one that's looking like the jackass, and it has nothing to do with me. So I can't really fault them for that.
I can't really fault them for that.
You can, but if that was
and me, I will.
If you so were, I can see a way in between you two on this one. I think on one level, he's definitely being a jackass. Right. But he's being a jackass because in my view, he represents this idea of rationality and that everything will get taken care of as long as we do things the right way. Right.
Right.
And, in the end, this idea that human rationality and the scientific approach will solve problems just fails. And it fails miserably in his case because he kills himself.
Uh-huh. Right. Well,
in my mind, that's just it shows the futility of a rational approach to a meaningless environment.
Well, and the thing about him is that he's looking at all these things and he, like you said, he has a rationality how it's working or whatever. But again, the reason he's a dick is because everybody else is a dick to him. So in other words, if people acted like they were supposed to act in that quote unquote rational world that he sees, he wouldn't have been a prick. In other words, his actions are a reaction to other people's actions.
Well,
so,
maybe, but at the same time, he must not have been to any wedding reception ever in his life.
Right.
Because this shit happens at every single wedding reception.
He probably should have just sucked it up. You're absolutely right. But
And I will say again, I know I said this earlier about the wedding band, but I really loved the depiction of this wedding because my God, it was so lackluster. Like, yeah, it was fabulous. And there was
they were on an 18-hole golf course, Christy.
Yeah, but there was talk about a dead wedding. Like, I was like, oh my God, this wedding looks so boring. Like, I would be outside smoking cigarettes and getting drunk because this is so boring. The music was lame. Everything was beautiful, but the music was lame. And it kept cracking me up because we would cut back to the wedding and then there would just be total silence. Like, the band wasn't playing and there's just this quiet murmuring going on. And I'm like, oh my God, what kind of wedding is this? Like, I've never been to a wedding that's like that. I mean, it's like so bad. And I know it was done intentionally. And that's what makes it cool. Because it was trying to show that, you know, getting back to Dan's point about life being meaningless and everything kind of not being important. And I get all that. But it just really cracked me up. I thought it was really well done. It just made me laugh. And it was a weird sequence of events at the wedding too for me, just because it felt like an eternity. Like, I think that Lars did a wonderful job of making this wedding seem to drag out forever so that the viewer would sort of feel kind of like Justine, that it's just dragging on forever, because it was like, okay, we're having dinner. We're doing a million speeches. And then, like, there's more dinner. And then there's some more speeches. And then there's, like, some dancing. And then there's all of a sudden these people are just milling out on the lawn and eating soup. And then you go back inside and then there's more dancing. I don't know. It was just, like, it was great. I loved it. I thought it was great.
I wanted to bring up something that Chrissy brought up, which is about the meaning of life and none of it matters and whatever. And, well, I guess I'll have been talking about that. But, you know, like, for example, I have two little girls right now. And, you know, one of them, you know, has a type of teddy bear that she thinks is the greatest thing ever. And, you know, it's just a teddy bear. It's like you know, who cares? I mean, she used to have a stuffed lobster that, you know, was her favorite and whatever. And the thing is that even though Lars von Trier is trying to say life is meaningless, and Faulkner and Shakespeare and all these other people have said the same thing with their art, you know, Edvard Munch and on, the thing is that it's only meaningless in it based off of your own perception. So my little girl who thinks the teddy bear is important, she makes it important because her perception says it's important and it's cute. And so as an adult with children now, I'm not as brooding and melancholy as I used to be. And so life is insignificant only based off of one's own views and not.
So you got to teach your kids right. Teach them that life is meaningless.
I'll take issue with the use of the word insignificant, because I don't think that's what it is. Because I think there's a level of meaninglessness that say, like, okay, there's really no inherent meaning to this, but it's not insignificant because it's incredibly beautiful. So one of the main things about it is like is to observe, to watch the beauty, even when that beauty is the result of this ending. And I think that's part of why the Kiefer Sutherland character kills himself, to set up a foil. Like, no, he science failed there because it didn't get to see the final act of beauty in the destruction.
Mm-hmm. So, that's a fair point. Obviously, William Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury, you know, life is the sound and the fury, taken right from Shakespeare's play. That's where the title came from. And sure, it's just sound and fury, and it signifies nothing, as Shakespeare says. And yet, it depends on how one looks at life as a perspective. For example, Justine looks at life as a whole, you know, the whole world, and to her, it means absolutely nothing. It's insignificant, if not to say a term that Dan disagrees with, but I'll rephrase it, is meaningless.
Well, there's plenty of people that rightfully disagree with me, so feel free.
Fair enough. But the point is that to her, in her worldview, it's meaningless and it should be destroyed and whatever. And yet, in the small world of, say, Claire, it shouldn't be destroyed, because, you know, she has a little child and she loves the child and she's trying to, you know what I'm saying? So if you live in a small village in the middle of nowhere, North Dakota, your world is significant in that town, and it doesn't have to, you don't have to look at the entire world and say, you know what? You see what's happening in North Korea or Iran or whatever, and say it means nothing. And I think that, again, is what I'm trying to say with it depends on your own perspective, and you determine your perspective and whatnot. So I guess I'm playing like a foil to Lars von Trier by saying that, in a sense. But that doesn't mean Lars von Trier doesn't have a point, because, I mean, he most certainly does, because, you know, once my father always said, and I think I've said this to Eric before in the podcast, you can look at the cemetery and find a lot of people that have been replaced by millions of other people. My father also said, you know, I retired, and 10 years later, I don't think anybody remembers that I worked there for 50 years, you know, so.
Yeah.
You know, so technically, Lars von Trier is correct. It's just that you don't have to look at it that way, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely agree that you don't have to look at it that way. I think he certainly looks at it that way. And
and he lives in a mansion just like this, probably.
Well, and I think that's why a lot of people don't like this movie, because it makes you confront that ultimate question: is existence really meaningful? And it depends on what levels you're looking at it from. The like a cosmic perspective, our existence is completely irrelevant. It doesn't mean anything,
right?
So it's and that's what this is. This is in a much. I mean, it's a planet colliding into a planet. It doesn't get more cosmic than that.
Right. Well, it's. No, go ahead, Phil, and then I'll say what I was going to say.
I was just going to say, you know, that's why they always say politics is local, because the, you know, the national level, who fucking cares? It really matters is, you know, your school system and your roads and your whatever, because that's the stuff you see daily and have to deal with every day. Comparing this film, say, to Midnight Cowboy, which is another film that's very, I guess life is meaningless. The difference between those characters and these characters is those characters live on marginal way, while these characters have everything. And so everything that's wrong with these characters, you could argue, is directly related to behavioral health rather than just bad luck or not having an education and whatever. And so I guess it just, you know, this is the thing where money doesn't necessarily make you happy, because
right that's what I was just going to say.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter how rich you are, you can still have these mental illness problems, because money can't do anything about that.
Right.
Well, and I
But
I also think too, and I kind of want to know what you guys think about this, since we're talking about, you know, what Dan just said about the question of it makes people think about existence and how significant our lives are or not. I really think it's a question of, there's some things in here that are very existentialist. And I wanted to know what you guys thought about, do you think that Kiefer Sutherland poisoned himself because the end of the world was coming, or do you think he poisoned himself because the system that he had always put stock in his entire life, which essentially was for him his reason for living, failed him? Which one do you think it was?
I think it's both, because
I agree with Phil. It's both. It's because you see how shaken he is when he comes to the realization that Melancholia is headed back towards Earth. He at first doesn't seem to be able to comprehend it, and then he does comprehend it. And the reason I'm being harsh on his character is because he's there with his wife and kid, right? And he doesn't even say anything.
he just
takes off and kills himself and leaves them to figure out what the fuck is going on. that's like a huge act of cowardice, that he can't even confront his family and tell them what's going on.
But I also think too, just on a sort of an unrelated note, Kiefer Sutherland makes such a great asshole. He really does. In movies where he's playing a total ass, like in this one, he's just really brilliant. And I think that particular scene that you mentioned where he just takes off and doesn't was just so well played. I mean, it was like you could see everything going on in his head without right. him having to say a word. It was just so well done.
Yeah.
Oh, there's no doubt that he's a top-notch actor for sure. Obviously, he's unfortunately been typecast as like a villainous type or a heavy.
Well, not necessarily. I think the most recent thing he's done is he's the president of the United States.
Oh, there you go.
He dies magnificently at the end of Pompeii. It's like one of my favorite movie deaths of all time.
Back to his character. I think, like I said, he was the guy that tried to make everybody centered and, you know, kept everybody strong. And then when he finds out that everything he believed about the world was wrong, and knowing that his fate was death, he just had a nervous breakdown and died. And again, you know, this is archetype, so obviously he was a coward and screwed everybody over and whatever. But again, if we look at this as real people, he just had a nervous breakdown and just couldn't deal with the ending, similar to his wife. He just did it the wrong way, obviously, because he should have, if he didn't have his own behavioral health issues, he would have sucked it up and just died with his family and tried to keep them centered. But again, he obviously had mental health issues or behavioral health issues more so than we knew. And so that's why I can't really blame him as badly as I would want to.
So on some levels, this film deals a lot with what was going on in the 19th century in Germany, and as far as philosophy goes. And one of the huge proponents of that is Schopenhauer. So there's a Schopenhauer quote that I think it's as if Kiefer Sutherland is living this quote. And the quote is, "The life of a man is a struggle for existence with the certainty of defeat."
Yeah. Wow. That's fantastic. I love that.
Yep.
Right. So this movie is just like replete with references to this sort of movement, but from like Schopenhauer through Nietzsche and to Heidegger.
Unfortunately,
I'm not going to disagree with you because I don't know any of them.
That's what I was about to
say. Yeah, I feel kind of stupid right now. Like,
Well, in a way, it's unfair. Like, he should tell people you should read this stuff before you watch this movie.
Right.
But then no one's going to watch it for sure. He probably needs to get paid.
Well, and you got to have the time. You really have to have the time and effort to do it. So.
Yeah.
And speaking of him getting paid, this movie was not commercially successful.
No. And in fairness, I had to read all this stuff in college. It's not like I sit around reading it now.
That's he kind of like sabotaged himself on mistake by saying stupid things at the time.
Oh, he sure did. Yes.
Yeah. It was like Mel Gibson saying his stupid shit right before Apocalypto came out. And, you know, and it was like, whoops, that wasn't good.
I think Lars was actually worse because he was actively doing an interview when it happened.
That's true. He wasn't drunk.
He might have been drunk, but he still knew that people were listening to what he was saying.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. For folks who want to, they can Google it, I guess. But unfortunately,
seen the video of it, Phil?
No.
It's really awkward because he's saying these things and Kirsten Dunst is standing right behind him. And after like the second really awful bad thing he says, she just like takes a step forward and puts his hand on his shoulder and goes, no, you need to stop.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask. I was going to wait until we got further into the podcast, but I guess we can bring it up now, which is, like, for example, Charlotte Gainsbourg has been used multiple times in his films. And yet Kirsten Dunst in this performance was probably the greatest performance out of any of his films, possibly. I mean, and we're talking Matt Dillon and Bjork and all these other people who had a great performances under working with him. Dunst, you know, won the best award at Cannes and most certainly could have been nominated for Academy Award, you know, if the Academy Award wasn't a bunch of garbage. My question is, why hasn't she worked with him again?
Bjork, for instance, fucking hates Lars von Trier. Okay. Shooting Dancer in the Dark was the most miserable experience of her life, and she has hate in her heart towards Lars von Trier. So I don't know if Kirsten Dunst had a similar experience or not, but it's possible.
Yeah,
I think that would just be something you'd have to look up if you were curious. Somebody out there's got to have the answer.
Yeah, because, I mean, you would think, if we're Lars von Trier's perspective, Dunst was so awesome in this film. I mean, she portrayed everything from like the nihilistic person to the depressed person to the realist to the goddess. And you would think he would say, you know what, I gotta bring this chick back into every friggin' movie I do. And yet, the person he keeps on bringing back is Charlotte Gainsbourg, who's no disrespect for her, she's great. But I mean, Dunst was just so awesome. You would think he would bring her back, you know?
If I had to hazard a guess, and this is a complete guess, I would say that Kirsten Dunst probably intentionally distanced herself from him after that incident and decided to leave it at that.
Yeah, okay, there you go. Yeah, that makes sense.
Because she is a commercially successful actress. She's been in some big stuff and some successful stuff. And I'm sure for at least a couple days after that whole thing went down, she was staring at the end of her career and was like, no, I'm not going out like this.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, who knows? I think there's a reason he goes with Charlotte Gainsbourg a lot. And that is, she is an actress that shares his sense of things need to be incredibly realistic and is willing to do what it takes to make that happen, where most actresses won't even go near it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right. I mean, for those who don't know what Dan's talking about, and not that Gainsbourg has done anything that would be considered pornographical or blue movie, because she's had body doubles in those films or computer graphics to do it.
Not has in had Nymphomaniac.
Oh, she actually had sexual intercourse in that, or
with all those men. Yes.
Okay, so for folks who don't know, Lars von Trier has had at least two films which both star Charlotte Gainsbourg that have what we would call NC-17, or if you want to be more 70s X-rated material in it, which would be Antichrist and Nymphomaniac 1 and 2. So yeah, that would make sense then that he would use her for those films. But you know, for example, Jack, the house that Jack built, that was not one of those type of films.
Right.
And Matt Dillon did that one. So, yeah, I mean, maybe that's the thing, is that he hasn't done enough films recently that would bring someone back like this actress here.
Yeah, I don't know. My feeling is if he were to write the right script that she would fit in, she would do it. I don't, because she doesn't strike me as a fearful actress.
Right.
But I think there just hasn't been a role that's right. And I don't think he writes things like just to make money. I think he writes what he's inspired to write, and some people can fill those roles.
Yeah. I mean, this film here required a little bit of nudity from her, but it was very artistic nudity to the point of like you know, blows you away. And she hasn't done much nudity at all in her career. So I see what you mean, Dan, where she wouldn't necessarily take certain risks that Lars von Trier would probably weigh.
Demand.
Demand. Yeah, exactly. So that makes sense. That makes some sense. Yeah.
Well, and also there's the fact that in addition to making his art, Lars von Trier likes controversy. He doesn't want people to be happy after they watch his movies.
He wants people to hate him.
I think I read something where he was saying that he was ultimately disappointed in himself for making this movie so polished.
I read that too, yeah.
Yeah. So he's not out to please people, which is probably why he hasn't been very successful, at least from a financial perspective. But he certainly gets attention.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, and Chrissy would appreciate that since she hasn't seen any of his films until this one. He says, this is his quote, not my personal opinion necessarily, this is his most commercially made film. In other words, most of his films would be less commercial than this.
Oh yes, yeah,
and that makes sense. And yet this is a true art house film through and through. So it just demonstrates the different type of filmmaker that he is compared to many, I guess. Now, what other things would we want to talk about in this film? Because we talked about some big things, but there, I'm sure there's some other scenes and other things that we haven't brought up that were of note that we could you know, figure out or find symbolism in or whatever. Anybody, Chrissy, I know you always list a bunch of stuff. There must be some scenes that you wanted to bring up that we haven't talked about. Because, for example, last week when we did Witchboard, at the very, very end, during your final assessment of that film, you said, oh, I forgot to bring this up, and I should have. But that film could be argued to be a commentary on the male ego or the male system of beliefs or whatever. And that after I edited that episode, I was like, damn, I wish he had brought that up, because that would have been 10 minutes of talk, because you're probably right. There must be other things in this film that you have written down that we don't want you to forget, like you did with Witchblood until the end.
I would like to comment on there are a couple things that are sort of small. I thought that the business with the red star, that she sees the red star and it's in the constellation on Antares, and which is, I think, wait, is Antares the star?
I think it is the star.
The significance of that was interesting to me, because it's the heart of the scorpion. That's what it's referred to as, constellation.
It's the very last line she says in her section of the film too.
Yeah.
So it's very important. So yeah, keep on going. Continue.
Yeah. So, I mean, scorpions to me can represent a lot of different things, but I just thought it was very interesting that they mentioned that particular star and that particular constellation, because scorpions have a sting, you know, they are very, they represent things that sting, things that are painful, in general, in symbolism. When you kind of get into talking about, when we go into paganism and we talk about what the scorpion is used for, in witchcraft and things like that. So I thought it was interesting because she was the one who noticed it. It is the scorpion constellation. And it was almost like when it vanished, it was foreshadowing that her time of pain and disconnection was going to be over. There are a lot of little foreshadowing things in here that I did kind of write down and just wanted to bring up really briefly. There's the business where they're talking. I think it's Claire and the son are talking, and the little, you know, she tells her son, we're alone. Life is only on Earth. And that's symbolic, again, of meaning that the two sisters are alone. They're isolated in their world and dealing with the illness and dysfunction. So that was also something I wanted to mention. And I have to say, that explosion at the end was awesome.
Oh, it was gorgeous.
That was beautiful. I mean, at the end of Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, the screen just goes to total white. At the end of These Final Hours, which Star Wars Rogue One totally ripped off shot for shot, you see the red coming at the screen, the fire coming at the screen. But in this one, there was something very inherently beautiful about the way that blew up. It wasn't fire. It was dust. And that ties back into the idea of life is meaningless and threat of existentialism that's running through this film. And that ashes to ashes, dust to dust, we all, in the end, will become dust. And like Dan was talking about that quote where in the end we will all be defeated. And so I thought that was a really nice connection there, that not only was it beautiful to watch, but, you know, he could have done fire and all this kind of stuff, and he didn't. He chose dust. And I thought that was really interesting.
I just want to mention the sound design too, because Dan's been over to the place. I got a fancy new sound bar recently, and it's got a little more rumble to it than my old one. And for most of the movie, it's mostly just the music and the dialogue. But that final scene, it gets awfully rumbly when that planet's coming up.
Yes, it does.
That's pretty awesome. That's, you need some subwoofification on that stuff.
I have that.
I
like what you brought up there, Chrissy, too, about the end of the world here. Obviously, we see the planet strike in that 10-minute preview at the beginning of the film. But at the end, where you think, okay, we're going to see the total destruction and the lightning coming out of her fingers as planet hits planet and all this other crap, he instead, what he does is goes to black. And I think, I don't know if it was because he was just trying to make it quote unquote real or some other thing, but yeah, I mean, when you die, right? I mean, unless you believe in the afterlife or whatever, it's like a light bulb turning off probably, where it's just your mind, the pain will be there for a second, but it won't even matter because once you're incinerated by the crash, everything's gone and there's nothing. And I think maybe that was partly why he chose it, because we're looking at it, plus we're looking at it in the perspective at that point, even though it's at that point, it's still Claire's story. We had already shifted back, oddly, to Justine's character at the very last few minutes of the film, mm-hmm. and her perspective and her way of seeing things would be, poof, everything's gone, and it's black and peace, and we're in the void.
And what did you think of her final confrontation with her sister? When her sisters was like, I just want us to sit on the patio and, you know...
Oh, I got things to say about that.
Well, even though I am a brooding person and whatever, generally melancholy and whatever, I am not. I don't try to be a mean person. I would have probably said, you know what? Okay, let's open the bottle of wine and listen to, you know, our favorite, you know, listen to Taylor Swift, for example, and just take it easy.
Oh yeah, we even have a disagreement.
Bill Collier can't get here soon enough.
Okay, but I said that to obviously to get us alive, you guys. But my point is that
go ahead.
I was just going to say that I think I mean, does it matter if she does? She have to be me? I mean, because they're all dead anyway within the next few hours. So it's like, why not make the last few hours of the people around me better if I can? Unless she looked at these people as they didn't help me yesterday or a couple of days ago at my wedding when I was calling out to them. You know, so I don't know. I think I would have just sucked it up and said, try to be kind to everybody and not just a little boy. But that's
now see, yeah, I think there's a couple things going on. First, like, she obviously, the wedding's a fiasco and she goes away for some period of time because they got to bring her back in a cab.
Yeah.
And we don't know how long that period of time is, but whatever it is.
Right. And we don't know if it was a institution or just, you know, take 3 weeks in, you know, Japan to,
right,
out, you know.
But she is clearly in the darkest throes of depression. Her sister Claire is trying to hold on to, believes that normalcy is going to solve the problem. So what Claire does is prepares meatloaf for her, because that's obviously Justine's favorite meal.
Right.
Then Justine goes to eat the meatloaf and says it tastes like ashes. So this act of like trying to like bring some normalcy and order to a thing that it's really
or
not
kindness,
gonna.
Or kindness. I can
right.
Look at it this.
But it's a it's a kindness that backfires because it's not really gonna address anything that's going on.
Sure.
So then we go to this scene where they're on the patio and Claire wants to have the wine and sort of just watch this unfold. But again,
and listen to Taylor Swift.
Right, but she's trying to make it an idyllic event, and it's not. And if you notice at that point, it's almost as if Justine has become completely realized in her melancholy. Like the idea that this doom is coming is sort of like liberating to her in a lot of ways. And she's eating the preserves with her fingers, and you can see like
right.
This, like
getting rid of the norms.
Yeah, but it's almost as if now for the first time in however long, she can experience pleasure knowing that what she was experiencing at the hands of like society is now just coming to an end, and what she always knew to be true is going to be realized. And having the wine on that, it would not be true to that character at all.
Yeah, all right, that's fair, because she has behavioral health issues. If she didn't have behavioral health issues, I would think she would want to treat her sister's upcoming doom similar to how we would treat people in hospice, where we would try to make them as comfortable as we possibly could.
She's
going to
die, too.
But that's my point. But she already knows she's done too, and she also
has.
What's
the fucking point of being nice?
And she also has behavioral health issues as well. My point is if she was a stronger person, what we thought Claire's husband was, they would have tried to keep everybody centered and just try to make their last moments as happy as possible, because the point of life, you would think, is the pursuit of happiness all the way to the end. So we would want to make people comfortable, but you could be a jerk like Eric, or you could be someone that has behavioral health issues like Justine.
Like Eric.
Justine, and just can't do those things that you would think a quote-unquote healthy person would be able to do.
See, and at the end, though, I don't like it, so there's like I said at the beginning, there's two levels of things going on here, because I definitely think that this is has a lot to do with depression and about depression and how it affects people on one level. But then on a level deeper than that, I think that's a vehicle in some ways for saying Justine is actually the one who is connected to what is really happening, and that it isn't so much a sickness when the truth is revealed. And that's why she's kind of liberated. It's not, you know, I think you could look at it both ways. It's like we look at it as mental illness when really it was just her understanding the truth of the meaninglessness of life. And then when that's coming to fruition and getting forced down everyone's throat, she's the one who is like accepting it and content with it.
All right. Well, let's say that she is now not mentally ill, or since she has been proven correct, then let's say if she's proven correct, the mental illness doesn't qualify. She doesn't qualify for behavioral health issues anymore. Then you would think just kindness, maybe then. So I that's why I want to.
Yeah, but the question I think would be then is kindness like I don't think she's being unkind. I think she's being like super kind and saying, no, we're not going to build these false structures to deal with this in the way you want to deal with it. We're just going to accept it for what it is and go with it, because that is ultimately what the reality is.
Then why doesn't she just say, go get the horse tranquilizers and stab yourself with it? Or if this was the United States, why don't you just go get the handgun in your nightstand and shoot yourself in the head?
Because that's what the rational individual does to take out of it. The point of this is witnessing the beauty. Like, that's all that there really is this beauty that we can see and be part of. Everything else is kind of meaningless other than that. So to not be there for that would be to, like, even worse than building some fake thing around it.
But listening to your favorite music and drinking wine, isn't that quote unquote beautiful?
I think those things can be beautiful, but I think when you are talking about like the end of the world and watching another planet collide into this one, to have any distraction would be doing yourself a disservice and not just embracing that thing wholeheartedly for all that it is.
Okay, but then if I continue, does it matter once the planet hits whether you ignored it or not, because you're dead?
No, well, nothing ever really matters.
Yeah, that's right. I think
why does it matter to pay attention to the planet hitting Earth or just drinking the wine? I don't think it matters either way, I guess, except by your perspective. Go on, Chrissy.
Right. What I was going to say is that what Dan is saying is that it is a comment on how both of these characters are different, first of all, and how they handle despair, you know, because most people would be despairing. And like we talked about earlier, she is accepting of this because she has understood this all along. And I think one of the themes of this movie, like Dan is saying, is that there is beauty sometimes just everywhere. And that's just what we have is right here, right now. And yes, I agree with you. Drinking wine and doing music, if the end of the world were coming, I would be drunk off my ass. I would tell you that right now. I'd just be like, let's get drunk and have sex until the world ends. It's fine.
Yeah, but like that every other day.
Yeah, well, okay. But really? You're going to give away all my secrets, Eric. But I think where Dan is going with this is that is, I think, one of the thematic points that Lars was trying to make with this argument. It's a thematic point to the movie. It's not necessarily whether it's a judgment call of who would do what. It's the point of the movie. It's the point of what he's trying to say about these characters. Not that one thing is, right, you know, the quote right or wrong way to do it, because everybody's going to deal with it. Like you said, some people are going to kill themselves first so they don't have to deal. And you know what's interesting, Phil? Getting back to these final hours, we saw these same reactions in these final hours as well. There was that big orgy party where they were all like rocked out and drunk and high and having sex in the pool. Then there were there was the family that holed up in the cabin in their camp and just killed themselves with the record going. And then there was the other
people that just wanted to be left alone.
They wanted to be left alone. So I think that's the same. I just find that interesting that there's that connection between the two films. I wonder if any other apocalyptic films kind of look at that same triad of personalities. I'd have to really kind of look at that. Anyway, I got us off topic. Sorry. Go.
Well, I don't think you got us off topic at all. I think you're absolutely right. I'm debating I'm looking at the scene when they have that fight as how people should react, and how, if you're dead, does it matter if you're orgying or if you're watching the planet hit?
Quickly, Phil, I just want to tell Chrissy, if you go to the Wikipedia page for Melancholia, in that Wikipedia entry, there is a link to a list of apocalyptic films if you'd like to look at it.
Oh, thank you. I'm going to do that. Thanks.
You're right. The film wasn't made for that scene to be looked at how I was looking at it. It was like you said, a thematic point that he was trying to state in his world, quote-unquote, world view. I mean, in a sense, I think. Similar to, like, you know, House to Jack built Eric. I think you're more apt to be right than me. I just wanted to be looking. I thought it would be a neat talking point, talking about it as if it was people talking.
Right. I think it is a good point, right? Because that's what you would expect a normal, well-adjusted person to do. But at the beginning, I think they kind of set her up is this super self-absorbed, hyper-aggressive nihilist. And this last ditch attempt at normalcy that like brings that out in her, like at a level that like she's sort of lashing out about, no, finally the world's going to be my way. We're not doing this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a selfish act followed immediately by her one selfless act.
Right.
But in a way, you could say, because I was talking earlier about how the planet Melancholia comes back to destroy everything, and that's kind of what happens to her life. Had the end of the world not come about, really, she just kind of implodes her own life there at her own wedding reception.
Yeah, so that I think you're right. So there's two levels, right? There's Melancholia, the planet that's going to destroy what we would consider beautiful, which is life on Earth, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a big overarching thing. And then on another level, her particular condition of Melancholia is destroying a beautiful bride, right? So she's beautiful at the beginning, and at the end, she looks like she's been in a psych ward for 6 months.
Right. Right,
and she's eating strawberry jam out of a jar with her hands. I mean, it's well, so on two levels, Melancholia has destroyed what's beautiful.
You know what? What is interesting, though, is that Melancholia, the scene that she's even more beautiful than at the wedding is the scene during Claire's part when Justine knows that the world's over and she can feel at peace that her existence of being depressed is going to end. She goes out naked and lays in the grass and all that, and we have that beautiful scene. And that actually occurs after the wedding, after she's come back in the cab. So it is kind of curious that even before the last 20 minutes of the film, when she just dresses down and eats jam from her hand, she already turned to her most beautiful when she was already back and her life had already been destroyed, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's kind of curious. And I can't recall quite the sequence, right? But at one point she says the earth does, when she says the earth deserves to die, is that before or after her being naked on that riverbank or whatever it is?
I think that's after.
I can't quite remember.
See, you think she says it after, or you think the naked scene is after?
I think the naked scene's before that. Okay. But I can't guarantee that, but I thought it was, to be honest.
Right.
But.
So I find it odd that there's it's not odd. It's sort of like that condition that she suffers. She seems to have a dislike for Earth. Right, it deserves to die, but yep. At the same time, there's like this highly erotic scene where it's just her with the earth.
Yep.
So I think that's weird or interesting. I don't know.
Well, that's the thing is like she is beautiful at the wedding, right? Really beautiful, and then she comes back, and then she becomes a goddess. After she comes back, and then after that scene is when she goes down to, I guess, the Plain Jane and whatnot. And yeah, so, I mean, it's an interesting cycle. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's stuff that both you and I and Eric and Chrissy are missing that someone else, I'm sure, could email us or a critic has already written about. But I wanted to read more about that goddess scene and its meaning, because again, not only is she become like a goddess, but the sister finds her that way. And that's important as well. So I don't know what any of that means, except that maybe she's one, maybe. I mean, her belief of what the world is and should be has come true, and that is quote unquote beautiful or something. I don't know. I'm just guessing at this point.
Yeah, maybe.
Now, anybody else have any opinions on that scene? Because we didn't really talk about that scene. And again, that scene was after the wedding, after the disaster, after she was probably quote unquote committed for a little bit.
I think you're right that she's at peace. Because things are finally turning out the way that she always thought they would.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I've pretty much said everything, Phil. I'm glad you gave me that opportunity to mention those few little things I wanted to mention. I don't really have anything else that jumped out at me. I'm sure you guys do, and I could comment on it, but I'm pretty much said everything I wanted to say about this.
Nah, I'm good.
Yeah,
I'm tapped.
Sure, sounds good. All right, so we already did the house cleaning for Ascansity, where Dan does another podcast with his buddy Eric. But Chrissy, you actually had a signing, and I know you mentioned it a little bit on Witch Board episode, but I wanted to talk about that and why you did the signing.
Yes, my new book is called, first of all, I'm Chrissy Peterson Schoonover, and I am a writer of short fiction. You can find out more about me at my website at ChristyPetersonSchoonover.com, or you can just Google it. Even if you butcher the name, there's only one of me, so it's fine. You'll find me. My newest collection is called The Shadows Behind. It is a collection of dark short stories, and a couple of weeks ago, I had a very successful signing up at Howe Caverns in upstate New York, where I got married, and I know the owners, and they were like, oh, you have a new book, come up and do a signing, and it was a really, really great day. You can find out more about my books on my website, And also, I just need to mention that the guys from Dark Discussions here, Phil, Eric, Abe, and Mike, are all going to get copies of my book. I just have been... Yeah, I just haven't been. The reason you haven't gotten your free copies is because every time I ordered copies, I would sell them so fast, like within a day, and it takes 3 weeks for me to get more. And finally, yeah,
make money,
finally,
please.
I have enough copies to be like, okay, now I can go down the list of all of my friends that I wanted to have free copies and finally send them out. My housemate Charles came up to me the other day and goes, hey, that book got published in April. Am I still getting a copy? Like, what happened to that?
I do not have any expectation of being automatically entitled to a free copy of anything. So it's a bonus.
Yeah, but anyway, so I am going to send them. And also, I do have enough to do, Phil, that giveaway we talked about. So, Phil, I think you and I maybe need to talk on Messenger or on the phone sometime privately and just figure out what we're doing about that. Or maybe before a podcast episode or after. We can just figure out what we're doing. But that's it. That's all about me. The end.
All right. Sounds good. Sounds good. What's the name of that book again? So, and they can find it on Amazon, is it?
Yep. You can find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all those places you get books. The Shadows Behind.
All right. Very good. All right. And if people can't remember or figure out how to find her website, you can actually just go to darkdiscussions.com and on the front page on the right, there's a link directly to Christy's website, so you can follow her over there. And we're all on Facebook as well, including Dan as well, so if people want to follow us there. And then also Ascancity also has its own group and such. So, and you can follow that there. All right. So let's give our final thoughts on this film. So let's start with you, Dan.
I just think it's an awesome treatment of sort of a older school of philosophy. I like everything Lars von Trier does. So that it made me happy, and I hope I was able to add something, at least convince people that someone who lifts weight for a living might not be an idiot.
Well, you are college educated, so yeah. And you got a doctorate, so that
yeah.
Yeah, for me, yeah, this film is absolutely awesome. As I texted Eric last night, it's a shame that at the age of 29, when Kirsten Dunst made this film, she didn't become like a super, super, superstar. I mean, she had already been a superstar in the sense that she was in Spider-Man and all these other films and whatnot. But this role is so awesome that she does that you would figure that she could have became a huge A-lister. And for whatever reason, she was more like a secondary A-lister or whatever. And it's too bad because she's awesome. And this film shows it. The film is definitely... in my opinion, anyway, a masterpiece and worth checking out if you like depressing dramas and interactions of people and things of that nature, and if you like art house and whatnot. And I absolutely love this film, and it's a high recommend for me.
I also think it's worth checking out if you love comedies and hate yourself.
That is totally interesting. That is totally interesting. Sign me up. Sign me up right now. I have about six people that I could like recommend this movie to just based on what Dan said.
That's awesome.
It is awesome. Oh, and if you like, I think Kirsten Dunst is hot. Oh, this movie you got to see. All right. So, well,
somehow, Phil, I knew that naked scene was going to get you all riled up.
Yeah, well, it's not even that. It's the whole first half, right? She's wearing the low cut wedding dress, and it's like, holy smokes!
Settle down, Beavis.
Fair enough. All right, so Eric,
I think this is a great movie. It is gorgeous. Kirsten Dunst is amazing. It's got some really interesting things about depression. The music is great. The sound design is great. I think it's great all around. It's not going to be for everybody. some people would not be able to make it through the first half hour of this movie. But if you are, go ahead.
Sorry. No, no, I was going to say that's why they have superhero movies.
Well, exactly. Yeah, but if you're into film as art, you definitely want to check this out.
Absolutely. Chrissy.
Well, I went into this movie expecting something a little bit different. I'm just going to reiterate pretty much what I said up front. I think this discussion has really helped me appreciate this movie more, and I'm definitely going to go watch it a second time. But I definitely went into it expecting a little bit of a different structure. I was kind of hoping or was under the impression that it was going to have a little bit of a different type of a story set up. And I was thrown off by that. But I do like this film. I think it's interesting. Certainly the second half to me was more appealing to me. So if you like apocalyptic films, I think the second half of this is going to speak a little bit more loudly to you than the first half. Other than that, I definitely recommend it. But like everybody said, it's not going to be for everyone. And it is, I'm definitely going to say this is a slow burn. I know podcasts throw that term around all the time, like, oh, it's a slow burn, it's a slow burn. Well, sometimes a slow burn can just mean boring. I do not think that this means that in this case. I think it is really the first half of it, Justine's part of it, is very slow in getting developed. So you need to just be ready to kind of just watch that and ride with it and not expect. I mean, we don't even really hear about the planet until 1 hour and 11 minutes in. That's the first time the planet's mentioned.
Right.
Yep. So just a heads up.
Yep, absolutely. And that's the interesting thing. If you went in thinking about the end of the world with the planets and then you watch the first hour and 10 minutes, it's like, I thought this was about the end of the world and planets. You have a good point there, Chrissy. Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's kind of exactly what I did. I said, this wedding thing is interesting, but when are they going to get to that part? Like, right, you know?
Right. So. Yeah, it's like having a slasher fan watch Three Billboards and saying, when's Jason coming? When's Jason coming? What's going on here?
Oh, we forgot one interesting point I just realized.
Go ahead.
I don't know why you made me think of it. But at the end, when, like, Kiefer Sutherland's character is the one that believes in science and believes in scientists and everything's going to be normal, what he offers up is a solution to his wife's, Claire's, anxiety. Rather than science or anything, it's a coat hanger.
Well, that's kind of science.
Kind of.
It's just primitive science.
Well, it's actually their child's coat hanger.
I understand, but that's his solution. Right? Like, oh, this is going to be great. Just use this and everything will be okay.
And to be honest, for someone that's not a scientist, it makes sense. And it's so simple and yet makes sense. And sure enough, it did work because that's when she says, holy shit, it's actually coming back. We're doomed.
Yes.
So it is kind of funny that it backfires on him. Because,
well, not on him. He's dead already.
Yeah. Well. Right. But it was supposed to calm her down, and instead it turned around and it's actually coming back. This is not good.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah, that's a fair point. Real good point. Now before we wrap it up, Eric, next time Mike's not around, we can do either Antichrist, Nymphomaniac, or Dogville, and we can bring Dan back, I guess.
Oh my God.
I don't know if I want to watch Antichrist again, and I've been putting off watching Nymphomaniac as long as possible.
So, Dogville, then?
I've never seen that either.
All right, that's supposed to be a thriller, so we should probably do that one then.
Yeah, maybe.
All right, so we'll discuss. Dan, first of all, this is my first time actually talking to you in person
after hearing
hundreds of times and talking to you on Facebook, but it was finally nice to meet you, even though technically I did meet you for 1 minute last night when we did a test
run. Yeah, well, the pleasure was mine.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you. I look forward to you coming on as a guest again. This is really cool. I hear Eric talk about you all the time, so.
It comes
well, up. That's because we're lovers. We're not allowed to say that out loud, though.
There you go. There you go. We are what we call progressive folk here that and accept all lifestyles and so forth. So, Eric, your bisexuality is acceptable for us. on a side note, yeah, it would be great to have you back. I will try to convince Eric to do another Lars von Trier film. So even if he doesn't want to do Dogville, Antichrist, or Nymphomaniac will be quite fine with me. Dances worth dark anything, Eric. We got to do it. This is our opportunity when Mike's not around.
Yes,
and
yes,
and we can bring Dan back. Dan was an excellent addition for tonight's episode, and gives a lot of good stuff.
I do want to call out the fact that Dan did have to rearrange his schedule to join us tonight. So thank you, Dan, for doing that.
Oh no, that was I enjoyed this. It was fun.
Yeah, and the reason we did it on a Wednesday night instead of our usual Thursday is because I had to rearrange my schedule for my father-in-law for his birthday and all that stuff. So these things do happen, unfortunately.
No, I still get to go to band practice tomorrow night, so that's good.
Woo-hoo. There you go. Hopefully you could rearrange your appointment with your customer, too, for working out. I think, didn't you have one tonight that you were supposed to do, and it was pushed back?
Oh, I own the gym, and I teach classes. I just had to have a coach cover my classes tonight. That was all.
Oh, okay.
Well, I'm excited because this means tomorrow night I can go to my neighbor's and drink and go in his hot tub.
There you go.
Like I said, every other day.
Yep, and Chrissy, I didn't want to tell you, but there's a planet called Melancholia that's going to hit tomorrow night. So.
Oh, awesome. I'll be watching from my neighbor's hot tub. It'll be great.
There you go. Make sure you're playing Taylor Swift.
That's right. Yeah, so you get to play Taylor Swift, drink your wine, and watch it all at once. So you're doing both. You're doing both Claire.
I think I'm going to take the Kiefer Sutherland route.
And if you're near a hot tub.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to leave the world like I came into it, hot and wet.
All righty, then.
All right. With that one line, I think, Eric, you can lead us out for tonight.
All right. Thanks for tuning in and listening. Let's talk about Melancholia. Come back next week. We'll have another topic.